In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. State capitals across our nation, we've been hearing in our news, bracing for this spillover from last week's violent assault in Washington. Coming up later, a look at extra security here in Iowa, in our state capital. Also, I'll have a conversation with Lieutenant Kevin Waldron about the 265 Iowa National Guardsmen and women to provide extra security in our nation's capital, in Washington, D.C. But first, lawmakers return to Des Moines this week for the first week of the session in the Iowa legislature. Let's find out some of the highlights about what happened from Kathy Obradovich, editor-in-chief of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Ben. How you doing?
Well, I'm fine. So at the beginning of this session, let's remind everyone, Republicans continue their unified control of Iowa's governments, Iowa's government having majorities in both chambers. Governor Kim Reynolds delivered her condition of the state address Tuesday night. Instead of the usual morning slot, she spent a good deal of her speech looking back at this tumultuous year, 2020, behind us, thankfully. The derecho, the drought, racial justice protests, of course, the pandemic. Take us through some of the highlights you heard from her.
Yeah, Governor Reynolds said she wanted to talk directly to the people. And it was a kind of a long address, and a lot of, as you just said, was looking back over the real significant challenges that we've had this year. You know, including the derecho and the, and of course the coronavirus pandemic. But she also laid out a pretty lengthy and I would say pretty ambitious agenda, considering the continued uncertainty about state revenues under the, as the pandemic really hasn't ended yet, including a major income tax cut. This is not a new income tax cut. The legislature approved the framework for this in 2018, but the next phase of it was waiting for state revenues to reach a certain, what they call a trigger, and that was to reach a 4% growth level. State revenues are not likely to reach that 4% level, but the governor in her address said, hey, let's just do away with that trigger and go ahead and complete this income tax cut that lawmakers envisioned in 2018. So that is something that will be interesting to see how Republican legislators deal with it. Not that they won't reject this idea. I don't envision them rejecting the idea, but I would say that they might want to even go even further and cut taxes more, which will be an interesting proposition. Major spending in the budget as well for, she called for universal broadband and an ambitious goal to have every part of the state have a, what she called affordable high-speed broadband by 2025. Now that is a fairly short time period, and she's really asking for $150 million over a three-year period to get that done. Again, bipartisan goal. They may quibble over the money.
Right.
And then I do want to spend a little bit more time on education, because I think that that is one of the more controversial of her proposals. And it's bifold. One, she wants all Iowa children to have the opportunity to be 100% in the classroom if their parents want them to be. And that is very different from the way schools have been operating under the pandemic. They have been getting waivers to operate at least half of their time virtually during the pandemic, because they might have staff out, they might have students infected. So that is very different and going to be controversial.
Right. And Kathy, we have a little bit of audio of the governor from Tuesday night explaining why she feels that's important. Governor Kim Reynolds, Tuesday night in her condition of the state address.
The vast majority of our schools found a way to safely and responsibly reopen all day, Monday through Friday. It's past time that every district make that happen. As one parent told me, options are good, but if some parents get the option to go 100% online, why don't my kids get the option to be 100% in the classroom? And I agree. So tonight, I'm asking the legislature to immediately send a bill to my desk that gives parents the choice to send their children back to school full time. We can't wait any longer, and our kids can't wait any longer.
Okay, Kathy, we'll watch to see how that controversy develops, as it certainly would be something also carrying over from 2020. Governor Reynolds on Tuesday night also proposing a criminal justice reform bill, combining two new laws in one. Let's listen to a little bit of the governor on that issue before you comment.
To that end, I'll be introducing a bill that protects law enforcement and continues our march towards racial justice. The bill will make it clear that if you riot or attack our men and women in uniform, you will be punished. We won't stand for it. The bill will also ban racial profiling and other forms of disparate treatment, because no actions should ever be taken based on the color of someone's skin.
Kathy, talk a little bit more about the two prongs of criminal justice reform proposed.
Yeah, this is an interesting proposal because the governor's criminal justice task force had been working over the past year under the chairmanship of Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg, and they came up with a pretty aggressive anti-racial profiling set of recommendations, including keeping data on traffic stops, racial data, maybe even asking Iowans to volunteer their race for their driver's license so that a police officer won't have to guess or ask in what could be a high tension situation. All of those things had agreement from not only the racial minority advocates like NAACP from the Black community, but also law enforcement. And it was a good compromise. What the governor's done has combined this with kind of back the badge kinds of issues, which the Black Lives Matter movement has already come out and said, they called it abhorrent yesterday, said there's no way that they can support the bill with this stuff in it. And among those things, enhanced penalty for harassment or assault of police officers, which of course is already illegal, increased penalties for, quote, riotous behavior. We haven't seen the bill, so we don't know what that is yet, but this is a description on the governor's website. Denying funding for local governments that reduce their budgets for law enforcement. So no defunding the police. Although, how stringent is that going to be? I don't know. And then finally, police officers could pursue civil remedies against a person who files a false complaint against them or injures them for representing law enforcement. But that false complaint issue is really problematic for the Black community because they say that will chill people with legitimate complaints from filing, because if they lose, they could get sued.
Right. And thoughts on her treatment during this Tuesday address of the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol last week, because it really ties into this issue and the Republicans' approach. Governor Reynolds, we have to mention, a solid supporter of President Trump throughout his tenure.
I mean, she has been, I think, consistent in saying that this is not acceptable and that it shouldn't be tolerated. However, she and other Republicans have been quick to draw a parallel with the Black Lives Matter demonstrations. Many of those also spiraled into violence or property damage. So they're really framing it in terms of a kind of a blanket, you know, Capitol riots bad, but also these other civil rights protests that may have had violence or property damage associated with them as well.
Mm-hmm. And finally, in the final minute we have together, Kathy, the Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice Susan Christensen gave her first condition of the judiciary message. Tell us briefly about that.
In tone and content, this is very different from a typical condition of the judiciary message. As Susan Christensen from Harlan is a former juvenile court judge, and she made it very, very clear that once the courts are past the pandemic, and she did talk about all the things the courts have done try to safely operate as much as possible during the pandemic. But once that's done, she said, her focus is going to be on making the courts more friendly for families and especially children. She wants to see, for example, some alternative court treatment for families. She wants to see more intervention to prevent children from being removed from the home. And if children have to be removed from the home, to get them in with a family or friend instead of foster care. And that was her big focus. She called herself Susie. She introduced herself to the lawmakers as Susie. She said she used to be called the cookie judge. I mean, it was very much
Susie
kind of
Q.
A warm, kind of a warm get to know you thing. And remarkably, she did not ask for money, which is very interesting because her budget does ask for a 5% increase for the courts. But she did not underscore those needs in her address to lawmakers, which was an interesting approach.
Okay. Kathy, thank you so much for joining us today. Kathy Obradovich, editor-in-chief of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. Until next time, Kathy, thanks.
Thanks for having me, Ben. Stay well.
You too. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our country rapidly closing in on 400,000 deaths from the coronavirus, with an average of more than 3,000 deaths per day. That's more than died on 9/11 day after day on average for some time now. Yesterday, more than 4,400 deaths in our nation. That's a record. Here in Iowa, more than 4,000 COVID deaths total. Let's get some more updates. 10 months into this cruel pandemic from Michaela Ram, healthcare reporter for the Gazette. Hi, Michaela.
Hi, Ben.
Well, as officials continue the effort to distribute the COVID-19 vaccine across our state, tell us, how will Iowans know they qualify?
Yeah, so the state actually this week just put out a new set of guidelines for the next phase of people who qualify for the COVID-19 vaccine. These people fall under what's called Phase 1B. So Phase 1 subset B of the priority population. The state has made that list public, and among those that qualify for this new vaccine are those age 75 and older, school teachers, childcare workers, first responders, and a number of other essential workforces and those who are also at risk. So the state has made that public, and talking with local public health officials, they say they're using any means necessary to let people know when and how that they can get the vaccine. Of course, once that information becomes available, some of that information is still forthcoming, but they're working on making sure the public knows where they can get that vaccine.
Mm-hmm. So listeners at home in those age categories, for instance, shouldn't reach out. They will be contacted by phone, by email. Is that what you're saying? Is that what the officials are saying?
So that is unclear at this point, unfortunately. Public health officials are saying that they are getting a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails, but unfortunately at this time, they just don't have a lot of information to share with these populations. The state released its list, but didn't really clarify, you know, whether these populations were going to be prioritized, how many doses are going to be available, you know, and talking with Linn County public health officials, they're saying that they're still in the midst of inoculating the Phase 1A population, which includes frontline healthcare workers and residents and staff at long-term care facilities. They say that could take several weeks still. So they don't want to try to get people's hopes up too much. They don't really have a date to give you, and they don't really have a place where you can go or even a list to really put your name on at this point, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so to be determined, those things. We'll hopefully hear about those in the near future. Where are people to be vaccinated? What places?
Yeah, of course. So at this point, we know for sure that you will likely be able to get a vaccine at your local doctor's office, the local pharmacy down the street, anywhere that has a healthcare professional able to inoculate or administer shots. Mm-hmm. I think the state said that they have about 1,700 of these kind of facilities signed on. Now, if you qualify under this essential workforce, so say you're a police officer, it's likely that your police department will coordinate that vaccine for you. The local public health officials say that they will match those employers with a vaccine host, and the vaccine host will work with that employer to try to figure out how to get those employees vaccines. That may happen at the workplace, or the employee may have to travel to the vaccine host. That has yet to be determined, but that will be coordinated by the employer.
And because this is a two-dose vaccination, you have to have documentation. You have to know where you are, or the person providing the shot the first time has to know whether it's your first or second shot as we progress further, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely. So I think the state and local entities are really working hard to make sure that they're tracking that closely, because that's important to know, to make sure that these people are protected properly.
Mm-hmm. We've been hearing, of course, the limited supplies of vaccines against the novel coronavirus have hampered some local efforts to inoculate the frontline healthcare workers. You said we're still working on those. Tell us more about the supply.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Linn County Public Health said that because of the limited supply, they really can't give a lot of details about when this next priority population will be administered. So, you know, looking at the state public health website, it looks like as of Wednesday, about 109,000 doses have been administered. And I believe Director Garcia, who is the interim public health director, said that about 200,000 doses have been administered to the state of Iowa. But unfortunately, it'll take somewhere between 300,000 to 400,000 to finish inoculating that 1A priority population. Luckily, the Director Garcia told state lawmakers this week that may change. Federal officials have made it known that they are looking at changing their practice, and hopefully we'll be able to allocate more of these doses to states. Currently, federal officials, you know, whatever number of doses that they administer to states, they hold that same number in reserve to make sure that these populations that have their first dose will be able to get their second dose. Now, federal officials are looking at changing that practice and will be able to offer all of those doses at the same time, which will help quickly speed up the process of vaccine rollout here.
Michaela, of course, all eyes on Washington next week with the inauguration of our new president. Is that likely to affect the vaccine campaign dramatically or soon?
We should be finding out more information about that, I believe, today. The Biden administration has made it known that they also don't want to encourage or continue this practice of holding a number of doses in reserve to ensure that populations that get their first dose will be guaranteed their second dose. They would like to see the vaccine rollout speed up across the nation, and so it's likely that they will release those doses. Now, you know, the Trump administration has also made that known, so it's unclear if the Biden administration will make any more dramatic changes to vaccine rollout. Unfortunately, we'll have to wait and see what happens next week.
Okay. Michaela Ram, healthcare reporter with the Gazette. Thank you for the update, Michaela.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end this news week. Because of the attack on the U.S. Capitol last week, all states and territories have been asked to help provide additional security during President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration next week. Iowa is sending 265 soldiers and airmen to our nation's capital. We're joined now by Kevin Waldron, Deputy Public Affairs Officer with the Iowa National Guard. Lieutenant Waldron, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. I really appreciate you having me on here this morning.
Well, we're very interested in what Iowa's guardsmen and women will be doing. Tell us.
So the Iowa National Guard has been requested or mobilized to support a number of different roles when they arrive out in D.C. Those roles could be anywhere from logistical to support to just manning the parade route. In the past, we've also conducted other missions, such as cybersecurity, and just making sure that the transition of power that's occurring happens peacefully.
Mm-hmm. And will they be armed with live rounds?
So at this time, I am not the right person to answer that question. We do not have operational authority over the National Guard members that we are sending out to D.C.
Tell me a little bit more about the situations the Guardsmen and women from Iowa are trained for, are expecting, the scenarios that may pop up that they are trained to deal with.
Sure, yeah. So the Iowa National Guard has several units within our capabilities that are constantly training on different scenarios to respond to civil unrest, if you will, or peaceful protests. And so that training might include baton training with riot gear and shields and whatnot, or just as simple as our use of force. So if a civilian comes up to a service member, how do we react? Is it going to be initially that we respond with different types of force, and we will respond accordingly? So those are some of the things that our soldiers and airmen are trained on.
Mm-hmm. As I'm sure you've heard in the news, Lieutenant, there have been calls for a full investigation into the actions of the Capitol Police last Wednesday into what lawmakers have called severe systemic failure that allowed an angry mob of Trump loyalists to storm the Capitol. It's an episode that left 5 people dead, including one police, Capitol Police officer. We've had these widely circulated videos appearing to show some officers allowing the rioters to enter the building or treating them, I guess, in just a sympathetic manner. This while their colleagues were being assaulted. We've had officers suspended in the Capitol Police, one who took selfies with members of the crowd, another who put a Make America Great Again hat on and directed rioters, according to some reports, into the Capitol. How are Iowa's soldiers and airmen trained to stay out of the politics?
Yeah, sure. So the Iowa National Guard trains our service members to be respectful of everyone. The Black Lives Matter movement here in the summer of 2020 really taught us a lot about how to respond appropriately to everyone's First Amendment right to a peaceful protest. And that has taught us how we need to train for an event like the inauguration, where we potentially could see people that may not be peacefully protesting, that they are combative, and we will respond appropriately. We will respond respectfully.
Okay, thank you very much. Lieutenant, First Lieutenant Kevin Waldron, Deputy Public Affairs Officer with the Iowa National Guard, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in a few minutes, presidential historian Tim Walsh joins us to talk about the uncharted territory we are navigating as a nation. Also, we'll groove into the weekend with IPR's Tony Daner. But first, officials in state capitals across our nation are bracing for a spillover from last week's violent assault on the U.S. Capitol. Legislatures in other states have already become targets for protesters in the lead-up to the inauguration of the incoming president, Joe Biden. Let's find out about the additional security in place in our state capitol. Stephen Bayens is with us, Commissioner of the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Commissioner Bayens, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I see on your resume you previously served as U.S. Attorney, Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Iowa, assigned to combat violent crime. A good resume for this particular job. What security measures are in place at the State House?
Yes. I mean, obviously, we are constantly monitoring the threat picture, both here in Iowa and across the nation. And we have taken some proactive steps to make sure that folks can freely attend the Capitol and participate in the legislative process. So we have increased our uniform support. Currently, we are not seeing any concrete threats that would cause us any grave concerns. However, you know, we always prepare for the worst and expect the best. Obviously, with us being here in Iowa, we are blessed to have kind of good folks that generally approach these way their democratic responsibilities in a safe and appropriate way. But nonetheless, we know that there are folks out there that may have other agendas and may not be prone to acting appropriately. And so we've increased both our uniform and non-uniform presence up at the Capitol. Additionally, the Iowa Department of Public Safety has a division of intelligence. And so we have a fleet of analysts that are constantly examining social media, are working with federal and local partners on emerging threats, and are providing us real-time information virtually 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if threats do arise that are concrete, we can react appropriately. You know, the Iowa State Patrol has been charged with protecting the Capitol for the better part of 50 or 60 years, and we have a significant presence on the Capitol complex and are ready to respond as needed.
Commissioner Bayens, can you tell us anything about the groups that your analysts, the people in the intelligence part of this equation, have their eyes on in particular?
I mean, really, we're examining it in all areas of concern. It's not necessarily left or right. It is individuals that are on extreme ends of that spectrum predominantly. So we are looking at individuals that are professing violence, are encouraging violence. Those are the sorts of folks that we are looking at. We are not looking at individuals who just simply subscribe to political beliefs, but rather are proposing violence, proposing criminal activity, and appear to be planning such events.
Mm-hmm. But given what happened last week in the U.S. Capitol, obviously taken by surprise there with what happened, were there significant adjustments made because of that horrendous event?
Absolutely. I mean, that was certainly a flashpoint, and that's one of the things that we have seen, throughout kind of this tumultuous year is, you know, there are various flashpoints, and obviously you need to be responsive as a law enforcement agency when you see those flashpoints arise. Because in most respects, when those flashpoints occur, you're going to have a group of individuals that are on one side or another of that flashpoint, and that may motivate them to engage in a cause or engage in actions that they wouldn't otherwise be prone to. And so it's just very important for us to monitor those flashpoints whenever we see them across the nation and be prepared to respond appropriately.
Mm-hmm. It may seem to some that there's a clear line between protesting and what is not acceptable. Peaceful protesting, of course, acceptable in our country. We protect that right. Rioting and the like, not. How do officers know when that line has been crossed by individuals or groups?
Yeah, it is difficult. I mean, and luckily for us with the Iowa State Patrol, we spend a fair amount of time and effort training our folks to negotiate kind of those difficult political waters at times. But it is, and it can, the dynamics of groups can change somewhat on a dime. You can have groups that are incredibly peaceful, and if those groups are maybe infiltrated by a group of agitators or folks that try to manipulate group dynamics to weaponize it, that's when things change. And really, that's what we have to constantly be monitoring is the tenor of the group. You know, is it going to stay predominantly peaceful? What subtle shifts in either the rhetoric or the actions are we starting to see? Are we seeing folks start to employ weapons or throwing rocks or taking other measures. And so really it's a very fluid and dynamic situation, and it really is incumbent upon our officers to have a good sense of assessing those changing dynamics and to really only utilize any sort of active engagement if it truly is appropriate. And even then, it's usually a product of giving multiple warnings that the activity is no longer within the legal bounds of the Constitution and to comply appropriately.
Last week, we saw in widely circulated videos, the it appears to show some Capitol officers allowing rioters to enter the building or treating them just in a sympathetic manner. Has this led to more information, more training, further words to the enforcement officers to leave the politics out of performing their duty?
Oh, and that is something that we have driven into our officers' minds from the time they enter the academy. We are not the thought police. Our job is to uphold and enforce the law and to keep folks safe. It is not to embrace a political viewpoint or anything along those lines. And we truly attempt to protect the rights of all individuals. And that is something that is just innate in the Iowa State Patrol and the Department of Public Safety, which is, you know, courtesy, service, and protection to all people, and not to engage in politics, and that is not our role.
Mm-hmm. What would your message be for those listening who may be thinking of showing up to protest for one reason or another? Do's and don'ts?
Well, if you're there to protest and to exercise your First Amendment privileges, we encourage you to do so. We encourage you to do so in a safe and respectful manner, obviously. You know, when we start getting into issues where there's physical confrontations, you know, those are the events that really give us a lot of cause and concern. You know, folks that are inclined to protest obviously have deeply held beliefs. They may even tend to be emotional, and that's okay. But also to recognize that emotions can at times cause you to do things that are maybe outside of your character. And one of the worries that we have is, you know, when we have folks on polar opposites at times, emotions tend to boil over. And as a result, foolish decisions can get made. And so my suggestions and my hope for Iowans is to be passionate, but also to remember human decency.
Okay. Stephen Bayens, Commissioner of the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Thank you for these observations and these hints as we look forward to next week. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Just 5 days, Joe Biden will be sworn in as president. Putting his transition in the context of U.S. history, we know we are navigating in uncharted territory in so many ways. Joining us now to give us his observations in this terra incognita, presidential historian Tim Walch, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Hello once again, Tim.
Hi, Ben.
Describe
a week.
What a week. What a week. Describe the ways that you see the top ways in which what is happening and what is about to happen is unprecedented.
Right. I think what we've got here is a tale of two presidents. And when looking for analogies for President Trump, you want to perhaps compare him with Richard Nixon, that transition out of office with a reputation somewhat tarnished. And he faces a second trial, which, of course, is unprecedented and extraordinary. And he has to find attorneys to defend him. So that's going to present a big challenge for him going forward. He also has a lot of financial exposure in New York with the New York Attorney General and the Manhattan District Attorney. He's got to refinance a lot of his personal debt, all of that going forward. For him, I think the most important thing going forward is to try to regain his social media accounts, because he's kind of out of touch with his followers, with his sense of connection to the world. And then this question of legacy, which always concerns a lot of former presidents as they leave office. If he is convicted, and that's not altogether sure, He could be deprived not only of the option of running again in 2024, but he could be deprived of his pension. He could be deprived of some parts of the post-presidential benefits like travel and Secret Service protection. So that's his challenge. That's one presidential path. The other, of course, is Joe Biden. And he faces a challenge not unlike Franklin Roosevelt in 1932. But imagine if Franklin Roosevelt came into office and not only faced the Great Depression, but also World War II at the same time. Mm. Because Biden has the pandemic, which has killed hundreds of thousands of people. And, of course, he faces economic crisis. 965,000 people in net adjusted have applied for unemployment insurance in December. So, holy moly, what challenges both of these men face.
Mm. What are your thoughts, the interesting relationship between the vice president and the current president taking a twist in recent days? What are your thoughts on how that looks in historical perspective, Vice President Pence, his actions,
very
his words?
Yeah, very interesting, because, of course, what you had, of course, is a vice president who was very devoted to his president, Mike Pence and Donald Trump. But when Mike Pence basically asserted himself in saying he had no authority to do what the president wanted him to do, the president turned on him. And so it's been a frosty relationship these last few days. In most cases, a vice president's power, authority, prestige extends from his proximity to his president. And so in Mike Pence's case now, at least as far as real authority, it's diminished somewhat because President Trump is angry with him. But for some outside of the Trump orbit or that particular conservative bubble, he may have gained in his stature.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how this president is unlike other presidents in the way that he has really courted disaster in some ways, courted
right.
his own problems. Has there any been anything like that? I mean, he walks right into things. He's not hiding anything, is he?
Right. No. And you might imagine what would have happened if Huey Long had become president, the senator from Louisiana who had a strong populist following, or Father Coughlin, the sort of racist priest from Detroit who was so anti-Semitic. Words have consequences. And I think in many of the rallies, President Trump said things that were provocative and controversial, but didn't lead to the kind of violence we saw in the Capitol on the 6th. And all of a sudden, like Dr. Frankenstein, the monster is out of control. That having been said, the president was urged many times to express regret or to take responsibility, and he does not like to do those things. So he will leave office without having closed that issue or that issue of responsibility. One of the short-term challenges for him, too, is how does he depart? He wants to have a rally before he departs, but how can he do that at the same time Joe Biden is having an inauguration?
Right. We have about a minute left. Tim, other thoughts here. So many what-ifs to contemplate. What else
you
have
bet.
You been thinking about?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that occurred to me, and that this is a quote I saw in, I don't know, one of Peter Baker's columns, I think, that he quoted Franklin Roosevelt. Democracy is a living thing. It's a human thing, but it's also very fragile. And it's concern for all of us about the health of our democracy, so that we need to embrace our own personal responsibility for being good citizens and to hold dear what we have taken for granted.
Mm-hmm. Tim Walch, the inauguration day, you'll be tucked away at home as most of us are during this pandemic, watching it. Anything watching in particular as you watch the ceremony?
I do. Well, two things. I do hope that he does it outdoors because that's traditional and fundamental, that all the citizens of the United States can see the new president sworn in. And I hope he gives a traditional inaugural address, with the theme of which is come together, follow me. From George Washington to Joe Biden, come together, follow me, because we want to come together as a nation.
Fine words to leave us with. Tim Walch, presidential historian, director emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Always good to have your observations, your insights. Tim, you take care.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming to the end of this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Now with Tony Daner, IPR Studio One Tracks host. Hi, Tony.
Hey there, Ben. Happy New Year. Haven't talked to you in a while.
Oh, it has been that long.
You are here. Yeah.
You are here to groove us into the weekend. I'll add another verb there, to soothe us into the weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
We do need that. What have you got first up to bat for us?
Okay, so just a little prelude here. This is one of the slowest times of year for new music, you know, leading up to and coming out of the holidays. There's just not much going on, but we are starting to see a little bit of trickle in of new songs, and I've got a couple from kind of the Americana country rock genre. First from a singer-songwriter named Israel Nash, who has not put out a new album in a few years. He did put out an EP last fall called Topaz. They'll be expanded to a full album in March, and it includes this single that we just got in. And it's kind of a heavier, kind of thematically kind of a heavy song, but it's got a great groove to it. I really like this one. This is Down in the Country from Israel Nash.
Israel Nash. I like that selection, Tony. What else do you have for us?
Okay, a personal favorite of mine, Hiss Golden Messenger, one of those groups that is officially a band with a lot of members coming in and out, but it's really the project of a guy named MC Taylor from Durham, North Carolina, a very prolific singer-songwriter. The word soothe into the weekend. I find his music very reassuring. He's kind of a calming presence in my life and on the airwaves here at Studio One. This is a new single that just came in this week. Hopefully that means a new album soon from Hiss Golden Messenger. This is called Sanctuary.
Hiss Golden Messenger with Sanctuary. I like that one as well, Tony. I see what you mean by soothing. Remind us before we say goodbye and listen to the tail end of this, how can IPR fans listen to Studio One Tracks?
Sure. 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock on our new Studio One service or our 24-hour online Studio One stream. And you can also catch us Saturday afternoons at 2 to 4 o'clock. Mark Simmet will have our new featured release and classic tracks artist.
Okay, Tony Daner, IPR Studio One Tracks host. Have a great weekend, Tony.
Thanks, Ben. You too.
Special programming on Monday for Martin Luther King Jr. Day in place of this program. River to River, produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Shovel some snow and have a great weekend. Rich man cries like a crocodile.